Here in Venice, is all that's taking place in the United States that you're both deeply involved with means?
Well, one thing that comes to mind immediately is the connections. You know, at the moment that we're dealing with Black Lives Matter and the violence against Black people and brown people in the United States, Europe is experiencing incredible deaths of Black people here too. Actually, after Venice, I'm planning to go down to Lampedusa, which is the kind of the center of the migration, where people from the Near East and Africa come through Lampedusa in order to arrive in Europe. So this perilous state of people worldwide that have been subjugated to white supremacy and capitalism is the thing that I think of. And here is it's just one occasion among many to consider those connections.
Well, I wish we could continue this discussion, and we will. Sharifa Rhodes Pitts and Charles Gaines, the conversation continues. Sharifa Rhodes Pitts' book is called Harlem is Nowhere, A Journey to the Mecca of Black America. That does it for our broadcast. We have a social media editor full-time job opening in New York. Check our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to our crew here, Dennis Moynihan, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us from Venice, Italy.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today, we'll take another look at the fate of the Kurds, who are getting bombed yet again.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
Kick it! KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your right!
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com. Or by calling 503-230-2300.
Hey, Jorge Bido Castillo
Well, this is KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. It is FM, of course. And this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
Indeed it is.
It's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris.
Yep.
And we do want to hear from you, 231-8187. Today, we're going to revisit, because it's getting worse, the situation of the Kurdish peoples scattered throughout five countries. We'll talk about their history. We'll talk about their desires, first of all, they're 30 million people without a homeland. That is, I believe, the only group that size, maybe the Uyghurs in China. I'm not sure their numbers, but just about the only group that has never in modern times had a homeland of their own, a country of their own. And their history is very, very amazing. They are also, in modern terms, a very progressive society. And I think it's really important to understand their role in what's going on in the Middle East, in what John Stewart correctly called the Mesopotamia. And I think that the U.S. is about to step into it yet again. My concerns, and I think Abe's as well, is that in order to bring Turkey in line to fight ISIS, and get bases there in Turkey, the United States is willing to allow the Turks to attack their enemies, the Kurds, with bombings, which they've already done, and to smash the Kurdish efforts. The Kurds are unique in that they are the most effective fighters against ISIS so far in the region.
Yeah, they've done pretty well.
And they're very brave, and they have women in their armed forces, and women are treated equally. I mean, it's really quite an amazing society. And they span, as I say, five or more countries, depending on how you count, because part of them are in the former Soviet Union.
Most are in portions of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran.
Right.
In a contiguous area, which I think supports some of the calls to establish a Kurdish homeland right about now.
Right. And they were kind of tacitly given control of the north of Iraq during the Iraq war. And have, therefore, access, potentially, to a great deal of wealth from oil.
Yeah.
And that's a nice prize, which puts them both in the crosshairs of this struggle, and at the same time gives them hope for a national homeland.
So this program is picking up a conversation we started back in June. If you want to go back and listen to that show and also read some of the articles that are linked on that show's page, I encourage you to do so. That's at kboo.fm. You can search for our show and you can find it there. What's been happening recently is that, as Joe mentioned, the United States and the Turkish government are involved in an air war against the Islamic State, otherwise known as ISIS or ISIL or IS or any number of other acronyms. The Turks have recently granted the United States access to an air base in the southern part of Turkey. It's called Incirlik. I don't think I'm pronouncing that correctly. But anyway, there's American planes there, and they are carrying out airstrikes against ISIS. Turkey has sort of used this occasion to bomb positions held by, as Joe mentioned, its old internal enemy, the Kurds, specifically a group called the PKK, which is both the political and military arm of what is generally known as Turkish Kurdistan.
Yeah, and this is really important because when Turkey gets involved, that draws NATO, which was originally created to block Soviet imperial ambitions, and has now changed into something else entirely,
I think. Now it guards Western capitalist ambitions,
right.
One might.
Right. Well,
venture.
One might even say that was its original function.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, that draws the Western powers, as it were, into the conflict with ISIS more heavily than they already are involved. And with the Turkish effort to establish and strengthen its their own, under the current leadership, quasi-fascist government, that draws us into a behavior which supports that Turkish government, not the Turkish people. Let's be clear about that and separate the two. And I have asked a friend who I met only recently, who really knows the region, Bob Rossi, to join us. He has been to Turkestan, and I'm going to let him present himself right now. Bob, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you really good.
Good morning.
So, first of all, just for our audience, what are your bona fides? Well, how do you know and what do you know about Kurdistan and the Kurdish people?
Well, I try to visit every year. I support the Kurdish Liberation Movement very strongly. I do a daily blog called Harvest of news from the region and work very closely with groups there. Lately, we've been running a kind of a graphic on our blog that says we are all PKK. So the Turkish establishment frequently accuses us of being the voice of the Kurdistan Communities Union in the United States. I think that gives you some background about where we're coming from.
Sure. Can you quickly describe to us what the PKK is and its relation to the Turkish government?
Well, the PKK is started out as a party at a very different time in the 1970s and 1980s in North Kurdistan. It's evolved into a social system throughout the region, something much different than a party, I think. The Kandil region in northern Iraq, or we would say South Kurdistan, is an area larger than West Virginia, held by the guerrilla movement and the PKK, the Kurdistan Communities Union, and other organizations. It has a real presence throughout North Kurdistan or Southeast Turkey. Its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, has been imprisoned in Raleigh Island since 1997, when he was captured by the Turkish government with the help of the United States and Israel. Öcalan, while in prison, has developed a set of theories or a body of thought that has influenced liberation struggles throughout the region, particularly Rojava across the border in northern Syria. But his impact and his thinking have transformed the PKK, or helped transform the PKK into a social system and a movement. Does that help?
Oh, that helps a great deal.
Thank you.
One of the things that is probably of interest to our audience is the fact that under his direction, as I understand it, women have gained an enormous amount of equality within the constructs of the governing and the social movements of the Kurdish people.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that Öcalan did not invent that. I think he built on something that was there, and he has a particular genius for recognizing things in society that are positive and good, and figuring out ways to build on them. He's also not ashamed or embarrassed to do self-criticism, and the PKK has had a number of ideological and cultural turns over the year, and it's really still, after all this time, an evolving project. I think you're exactly right that in Rojava, particularly, women have a very strong role. 7% of the economy is reserved in Rojava for women's economic activity. 40% of all leading positions at a minimum are women's positions. And there is the co-chair system, which goes through North Kurdistan, Rojava, and everywhere there is a Kurdish revolutionary movement, which means that instead of voting for one person for an office, a man and a woman are elected on equal terms to the same office. This may not sound particularly radical, and I know that there are American groups that do this too, but in Turkey it's illegal. and Turkey's youngest mayor ever elected, who was elected as part of in Ahmet or Diyarbakir, as mayor of one of the sections of the city. She is facing 4 years in prison now as a result of having been elected on that platform with that program.
For having the temerity to seek public office.
To run with a man for the office and be elected as co-chairs, or co-mayors, yes.
So let me ask you, broadly speaking then, in the context of both the civil war in Syria and the uprising of the so-called Islamic State, what has that meant for the Kurdistani region in general, and in particular for the Kurds in the southern part of Turkey?
Well, let's think about it. Rojava declared autonomy of some sort in November of 2013. I think at that point, the situation was somewhat different than it is now, and Rojava needed some time to defend itself and struggle to become contiguous. The idea is, and this is one of Öcalan's ideas, that democratic confederalism is the best system available to people. That doesn't mean creating a state or a nation state. It means creating what are essentially cantons or communities that federate with one another.
As in the model of Switzerland.
Something like that, yeah, with a revolutionary socialist content, yeah. And but Rojava needed some time to figure this out, and the three cantons are still not autonomous despite much fighting. By September of 2014, ISIS, of course, was fully engaged in fighting Rojava and attacked Kobane, which is a city and a region. And Kobane, as I said last time on your show, is our generation's Stalingrad. That fighting went from September of 2014 to January of 2015, at which point our guerrillas declared victory and started doing mop-up operations, which are still continuing. Just before the attack on Kobane, there was also an attack on Sinjar in northern Iraq, which is a Yazidi region. The Yazidis are an ancient people, Zoroastrians. They're Kurds as well, and the fighting in Sinjar still continues. So this has been a disaster for people in Rojava and Sinjar. Rojava is embargoed by everyone, it seems. Sinjar is often forgotten about. But the people of North Kurdistan, that is southeast Turkey, mobilized very strongly to protect Rojava and to fight ISIS as well. Elections opened in Turkey, and the fight against ISIS became part of the election struggle. On June 5th, there was a terrorist attack against a rally of the People's Democratic Party, which is usually considered... The media always says pro-Kurdish, as if that's all the People's Democratic Party is, the HDP. The HDP has a very fully complete program beyond the Kurdish issue. But anyway, on June 5th, there was a terrorist attack on a HDP, People's Democratic Party rally, just before the June 7 elections. It was a terrible event. It capped a long period of violence against Kurds in Turkey. The June 7 elections gave the People's Democratic Party 80 seats in parliament. They entered parliament with a lot of optimism and proceeded to try to carry out a series of reforms. Turkey has a lame duck government, and one of two things has to happen. Either there has to be a new coalition government formed or early elections need to be called. And the government that's in place now seems kind of bent on doing early elections. So the elections process, to answer your question directly, the elections process became part of the struggle against ISIS. It became a point of mobilization in that fight. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
I think it's really important for Americans to understand that, as I see it, and you may want to correct me, but as I see it, the United States seems to be making basically a deal with a unpopular but powerful quasi-fascist government in Turkey, and a fairly corrupt government, in order to get bases and support and perhaps even troops, drawing from the power of NATO, to fight ISIS, and in the process of that, allowing the Turkish government to bomb Kurdish locations and to bomb the Kurds in general. This seems to me to be a disastrous policy. Apart from the injustice of it all, it is strategically very foolish, and will not resolve the enormous and inherent conflicts, ethnic conflicts, as well as cultural conflicts in the region. And I just am very concerned because the American press and what American people generally know is virtually almost nothing about the situation of the Kurds and almost nothing about the dangers of our becoming involved, the United States becoming directly involved in an ambitious nationalist Kurdish struggle. And I when I talk about this, I want always to remember the behavior of Turkey beginning with Ataturk after World War One. Where he disavowed a plan that would have given the Kurds a great deal of autonomy, and in which essentially there was a genocide that was, until modern times, very unprecedented with the Armenians. So we need to understand, Turkey has never acknowledged that injustice. We need to understand the situation. I want to also make a distinction between the people of Turkey and the current government of Turkey, and that's an important distinction.
Yeah, I think that follows really well on your previous point. Thank you. There is a history there, for sure. I would say that the Armenian genocide continues, although in a different form. It's a cultural genocide and a political genocide rather than killing people. Well, there are so few Armenians left after the 1915 genocide. So there's that. I think you're right that this has ethnic and religious dimensions to it. I'm sorry, I'm kind of stumbling because you said so much there. But prior to the June 7 elections, we were all very optimistic about things, and we have good reason to be, I think. The Turkish government was pretty isolated. It was clear that they were not going to win the elections and maintain their government. The United States and Europe seem to be doing the right thing in northern Syria, coordinating with the guerrilla movement in doing the bombings, coordinating with the guerrilla movement in Sinjar. Those are all good things. We can say I would say that the United States came too late and did too little, and the embargo on Rojava needs to be lifted, and a safe zone needs to be created for Sinjar. But to some limited extent, the United States is, and the Europeans have been very helpful. on right after the June 7 elections, the revolution in Rojava, of course, was what was progressing, and the People's Defense Forces, the YPG, and the Women's Defense Forces, the YPJ, and their allies moved eastward and took a Turkish Syrian border post that was held by ISIS, or town called Tel Abyad. And this just, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, flipped out at that point and said the terrorists were at the gates and had to be defeated and attacked. The YPG, the People's Defense Forces, and YPJ, Women's Defense Forces, turned south to go after Raqqa, which is the ISIS regional capital, and started moving in that direction, winning against ISIS all the way. Turkey is not under attack, but Erdogan has worked very hard to make it seem so. On July 20th, there was a terrorist attack done by ISIS in Sudic on the border. 33 people were killed, most of them young people, teenagers. who were affiliated with a socialist organization, and they were on their way to Kobane to do solidarity work. It was clearly an ISIS attack. It's hard to imagine, since Sudic is so surveilled. There are cameras and police and military everywhere. It's impossible to believe that the ISIS terrorists who did that attack did not have government help or support. But Erdogan used that as an excuse to then begin bombing and a massive crackdown on civil liberties, which continues has continued from roughly July 24th to now.
It would seem that the Turkish government's recent bombing of Kurdish positions would seem to be at cross purposes with its air war against the Islamic State. Haven't the Turkish forces collectively the Kurdish forces collectively, not only in Turkey but also in Syria and Iraq, haven't they formed a bulwark against the expansion of the Islamic State? Shouldn't Turkey be supporting them in this regard?
Yeah, the only successful fight against ISIS has been led by the People's Defense Forces and the Women's Defense Forces in Rojava, for sure. The United States and Europe got access to Incirlik Air Base and then changed their position and allowed Turkey to cross the border into Syria, as they did yesterday, and attack PKK positions, and, well, not just PKK, Kurdish positions generally. And while there have been attacks against ISIS, for sure, the bulk of the fighting has not been against ISIS. It's been against Kurds. So we're in a situation where the people who are fighting ISIS successfully have to fight with essentially a rear guard action to protect themselves while they fight. Yeah, that's right.
You know, I find from the basically isolated and isolationist, in a way, position of the United States in all of this, the general ignorance of the American people, giving essentially an opportunity for another set of bad decisions in Mesopotamia. And I'm very, very concerned, because my feeling about Obama, whatever his virtues or failures of virtue are, is that he and his administration seem incredibly, both historically and present day, ignorant about the struggles in the region. And this is not as bad as, but in a very serious way, it reminds me of the behavior of the previous Bush administration. And again, the U.S. is being drawn into combat in a region about which we seem to know very little. All we seem to know clearly is there's oil, and that oil is less valuable than it once was, but it's still valuable as a resource, and we want it. We want control of it. So once more, the United States looks to what I would call endless war for endless peace.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom to what you say. We might disagree about some of the details, but we're in a position now where perhaps 300 liberation movement fighters have been killed in recent weeks. We have probably 500 people affiliated with those organizations who have been arrested or are being detained. We have about 1,600 people detained overall, with about 350 people in prison, again, just in recent weeks, from the liberation movement, rather. We have 6,200 people, maybe, who are in prison for being members of the PKK and various related organizations. About 3,900 of them are supposed to be affiliated with the Kurdistan Communities Union. So the wrong people are in prison, and the United States is letting that happen. I want to be clear that the United States is not attacking Kurdish positions and continues to cooperate with the guerrillas, but they're also allowing Turkey to create a so-called security zone, which they've renamed to ISIS-free zone in northern Syria. That zone blocks, if it's carried out, that zone blocks Rojava's cantons from becoming contiguous. There already is an ISIS-free zone in northern Syria. It's called Rojava. Turkey needs to wake up to that. They've allowed a no-fly zone in northern Syria. Okay.
So, what is the official line from the United States regarding Turkey's bombing of Kurdish positions? Is it this just that this is an internal Turkish matter and we're staying out of it?
No. Well, you know that yesterday the two things or three things happened. First of all, Turkey crossed the Syrian border with some units, which are essentially contra units, I think we could say, and they've headed south to, we're not sure where. These are probably ethnic Turkmen armed and well-armed by Turkey. That creates a different situation than even last week. You also know that the U.S. consulate got hit yesterday by a group called the Revolutionary People's Liberation Party, or Front, DHKPC. No one was hurt in that attack, but it was one of a number of attacks carried out across Turkey yesterday. Dozens of more people have been arrested since then, and Turkish military hit, I think, 17 positions overnight held by guerrillas. So today, yesterday the Council of Europe softened its position and said, look, this is going too far. Turkey's departing from its democratic path through this process. And the Council of Europe seemed to take a softened position. Today, we again have the State Department guy, John Kirby, saying, making kind of contradictory statements. So his line today, as of this morning, was that the United States is not interested in changing Syria's borders. And this is, I think, to reassure people in Turkey as the United States sees the attacks increasing within Turkey, but also to send a message to the Turkish government about them crossing the borders yesterday.
Okay, Bob, I want to thank you very much. Is there something else you want to add?
Well, there are just a couple
first points. Of all, I want you to stick around while I take other calls, but okay, is there something you want to make clear now?
Sure, just three very quick things, if I may.
Sure.
First of all, yesterday in the news, the Patriotic Revolutionary Youth Movement, YDGH, figured very prominently in the news. That's a youth movement of the Kurdish Liberation Movement. It's part of a counter-power strategy that the Kurdish movement's developing to essentially declare non-cooperation and, in some places in Turkey, independence from the state. The second thing I want to mention is that there are international brigades fighting in Rojava and in Shengal. There are Americans there. People come from all over the world to help. This is the left in action. They're fighting for their lives, particularly in Sinjar.
When you say people are coming from all over the world to help, do you mean to come pick up a rifle and fight alongside the Kurds?
Yes.
Hmm. Yes. And can you give some examples?
What do you mean?
Who is coming?
Well, there are people from the left all over the world who are joining the struggle. As I said, there are people from the United States. There were recently several Spaniards who were arrested by the Spanish government when returning to Spain from Rojava. And, of course, a number of German fighters have been killed as well. Hmm. One of them was a young African woman who was associated with the Marxist-Leninist Communist Party, who died tragically.
Okay.
And has become, is a martyr of the movement, for sure.
Okay, please continue your earlier thought.
Yeah. The third thing I just want to say quickly is that people confuse Kurdish, when we talk about Kurdish issues, they confuse Kurdistan or the Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq with what we're talking about. The Kurdistan Regional Government is led by Barzani and his party, the Kurdistan Democratic Party. They should be facing elections next week in Iraqi Kurdistan. I think those elections may be canceled by Barzani. He's very close with the United States, and he's also very close with the Turkish government. They've behaved disgracefully where Kurdish long-term interests are involved. And so those are the three points I want to make.
I appreciate it very much. Can you just sort of stick around? We're going to go to the phones for local calls and so on.
Sure. This is the Abe and Joe Talk radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. You can also listen to us on the internet tubes, kboo.fm/Abe and Joe. And if you want to leave a comment on our Facebook page, you can do that at facebook.com/Abe and Joe. But if, more importantly, if you want to call in and take part in this conversation about the Kurds and Greater Kurdistan, you can do so at 503-231-8187. So I have a question for you. Given your druthers, how would you like to see, if you could have an ideal outcome for the people of Kurdistan, what would that outcome be?
Now, this is to Bob, right?
Right. what would you like to see happen?
Well, yeah, easy question.
Yeah.
I think the Kurdish struggle is intimately involved with the whole struggle for democracy in Turkey. There will not be democracy in Turkey until there's acknowledgement of the Armenian genocide, as you mentioned before, and as Kurdish and other minority rights are institutionalized and respected. So I want to see a democratic Turkey in which all minorities find their place and are able to live on equal terms with everyone else. If that means breaking up the country in a system of democratic and federalism, which I favor, then I think that's for the good. Rojava is the most advanced revolution I'm likely to see in my lifetime. And I want that to succeed and extend. Syria also, and throughout the Middle East, should be and is being influenced by Öcalan's ideas. So that's kind of the rough guide to what I'd like to see.
Ultimately, would you want to see an independent state for the Kurdish people?
We want something better than a state. Democratic confederalism is something much better than a state. The idea that people can live in freely associated communities on a socialist basis, regardless of internationally imposed borders,
I see,
with communal production as the social base, as the economic base, is a much more beautiful and much more practical and pragmatic solution. Rojava has no income tax. Rojava has no prisons. The police forces are security forces, and the predominant security forces is run by women. So we have to understand that the ISIS attacks are a counter-revolution against women's power and popular people's power. That has to go, and we need to institutionalize that people's power at the base. It's something much better than a nation state.
So you would ultimately like to see a series of autonomous Kurdish-speaking communities sprinkled throughout the Kurdish-speaking areas of Turkey, of Syria, of Iraq, of Iran?
Not just Kurdish areas, but everyone has the right to democratic autonomy democratic confederalism. I would rather struggle with the problem of how we unite those communities than whether those communities should exist or not.
I think this is very important, and I know we're stepping into territory with which our audience generally is very unfamiliar. And the fact that we're unfamiliar with all of this really speaks to the fact that our media, American media, has either deliberately or out of total ignorance ignored these issues and these struggles. And I think it's really important that this stuff take a major place in the dialogue, in the discussion of what's going on in Mesopotamia and in Turkey. And I really am concerned that the United States seems to be embarking in its struggle against ISIS, embarking on a program which strengthens the currently, I will call it fascist, I don't know what else to call it, the dictatorial government of Turkey, which is now a minority government that ought to be challenged in democratic elections and given an ordinary fair system, would probably fall to a more liberal government. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that this military presence isn't going to eventually turn on the Kurds. That's hard to believe. There was, of course, the attack on Kandil, the guerrilla-held area in northern Iraq, which by the Turkish government, which hit a village that was not associated with the guerrillas and killed a lot of people there just last week. I hope it's not a sign of things to come.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. People may not remember this, but part of the outrages of Saddam Hussein were his use of poison gases and so on against Turkish people. I mean, against Kurdish people in the north of Iraq. And that set a pattern that I'm afraid we're possibly likely to see yet again. I don't know about government, the so-called legitimate government of Syria, has used chemical weapons. So it's a situation that is very, very serious, and one in which I don't think the United States government is playing a knowledgeable or justice-related role. Anyway, I want to hear from our audience. I don't know if people are up on this and are well able to talk with us about it. I hope so. I also would like to hear from people who really disagree with what Bob and Abe and I have been talking about. 231-8187.
So I have another question for you, Bob, and this one goes back a little farther. And forgive me if I'm asking big, broad questions, but I'm trying to establish not only a context for current events, but an historical context here as well. So the region generally known as Kurdistan, as we've mentioned, is scattered mostly across parts of four states, the main part of it anyway. How did this come to pass? Why do we not see an independent nation on the map right now called Kurdistan or something like it?
Well, I think there were some moves for that. Understand that these were the borders that exist now were imposed after the First World War. Kurds are also divided linguistically and culturally. Themselves and create some difficulties. There was an experiment in Kurdish statehood in the mid-1940s in what is today Iran. It was a socialist experiment protected by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was forced to withdraw, and those people who led that effort were either killed or massacred or forced to go into exile. There were attempts going even a bit further back in Dersim in Turkey in the 1930s. There was a large scale revolt against centralized government. Maybe that revolt was backward looking in some respects, but regardless, the Turkish government bombed Dersim. Deported the people that were left. The fighting went on for at least 2 years. And it created a generation of martyrs, but also gave the Kurds certain experiences. So Kurdish attempts at government and self-government and statehood really haven't gone well over the years at all. And then add on the linguistic, religious, cultural differences, it makes for a complicated mosaic within Kurdish life.
You know, I think this is a topic that is extremely important. It is also extremely challenging for Americans. We have, as a culture, even if we're people who are aware of and opposed to the American policies in the war with Iraq and so on, we are not only ignorant, but unaware of the complexity of things in that region. And one of the reasons why I think this show is very important, discussing the Kurdish people and the possibility of a Kurdistan and so on, I think it's really important to understand the multiplicity of ethnic communities and of political communities and ideas. When you talk, Bob, about the whole question, you're putting this in the context of what I would call, in general, progressive politics. That is, notions where women have equality, notions where there is a democratic governmental form, all of which are basically pretty alien to the region previous to this to these wars. So hang on, and we're going to try to take some of our calls.
Lance, you're on the air.
Yeah, just a quick question. What's the connection between the Kurds and Iran and their history insofar as culture, and similarities as well as dissimilarities, and how that kind of counts, works in the backdrop of today's geopolitics. And I'll take the question off here.
Okay, Bob, I'm going to let you to respond to that. Can you?
Well, it's a hard question, but it's a very good one. It's a hard question, but it's a very good one. So, Kurdish people in Iran are, I would say, an oppressed minority. I have Iranian friends who disagree with that. The Iranian government is also very involved in Syrian affairs and is taking a lot of credit for fighting ISIS. I don't believe that that's credit that they fully deserve. That does not put us on the same side as the Iranian government. In fact, in Iran, the Kurdish movement, the Kurdish left movement, I should say, has revived quite a bit and has suffered for it a lot in recent months, particularly the women's movement.
So one of the things that I sense in all of this is an overriding difference, cultural difference, and perhaps a political difference between the views of a certain traditional Islamic ideas about the roles of women, and this would be true for both Sunni and Shia, and the behavior of the more modern, more recent Kurdish communities who are less concerned with that religious significantly religious attitude toward women, and more concerned with a notion of social justice that is more akin to the avowed ideas of the United States. And that strikes me as kind of ironic, since the U.S. is, I think, views the Kurds as kind of an inconvenient reality, since they're the best fighters against ISIS. We need sort of to support them, but they're not a convenient ally for us, given that we want support of NATO, and Turkey is a major player in NATO.
Yeah, I think the last caller's question, if I understood it, was a very large question about how nation states interact, and also at the same time how people's culture is affected or lives. And I think your question, or your point rather, follows up on that very well. But I'm still struggling with the caller's question. There's so much to say about Iran as a mosaic of peoples, if that's not too cliche, but we also have to recognize the oppression that Kurds face in Iran, modern Iran, today. There are Shia Kurds, there are Sunni Kurds, there are Alevi and Yazidi Kurds, there are Christian Kurds, there's a Jewish Kurdish community in Israel still.
I didn't know that.
The first woman rabbi was a Kurd. So Kurds are a multinational people. But when I was there last time, and I was talking with Kurdish friends about this, they said, you know, we don't agree with one another, but we know one another. And I think that's maybe the heart of the answer to the caller, and perhaps a response to what you just said as well. Kurds may not agree with one another, but they know one another.
So there's kind of an overarching ethnic sense of community,
or a political context to work within. Yeah.
Huh. That is very interesting. And what I'm really concerned about, and I mentioned it earlier, but it seems very likely to me, is that the United States, in order to effectively counter ISIS, will take the risk of allowing the Turks to attack their enemy, which is probably less ISIS and more the Kurds, in an effort to build a certain level of solidarity between Turkey and the U.S. in its struggle, the U.S.'s struggle against the ISIS movement. And this is a terrible irony. One of the most clear things about ISIS, apart from its barbarism, is that it is a fundamentalist and reactionary movement within the faith of Islam.
Yeah, and some of this has a particularly grisly side to it, right? The Turkish government is not allowing the bodies of at least 20 fighters killed in the fight against ISIS to be returned to their families in Turkey.
their bodies are stuck at the border. It's hot there, right? Mm. And this has been going on for days. Turkey handed over six wounded YPG, that is fighters from Rojava, to al-Nusra recently, in the last few days. And the United States, what is the United States doing? Come on, I mean, these are, in the bigger picture of things internationally, these are small things that the United States could at least comment on. But it would go a lot to assuring Kurds of goodwill, and we can't even get that out of the Obama administration.
Yeah, and I often wonder whether the Obama administration is, in fact, making a calculated, opportunistic effort in supporting the Turks so that they will, in fact, be engaged in the war against ISIS, or whether it's simply a case of ignorance and indifference on the part of the Obama administration. This is a question I don't know the answer to, and since the American press doesn't ever ask these kind of questions, we're unlikely to get an answer. And that disturbs me a great deal. We have other callers. I'm going to ask you, Bob, still to stick around because you know a hell of a lot more than I do, and certainly probably more than Abe. And,
oh, yeah, yeah. I'll give him that.
So stick about, and we'll take our next caller. The number is 231-8187. Who is it?
BT, good morning. Yeah,
good morning.
Last night and very early this morning, I was looking at a lot of news sites I get on, and AP and all kinds of things, foreign papers and everything, and I saw some stuff that made me think that the Turks are probably just taking advantage of situations with an air base now opened up, and it's rather than 100% U.S.-Turkish agreement. So I think there's something like a Turkish general had ordered their air force to bomb an area where on short notice, where we still had some Green Berets on the ground or something, and that the U.S. really didn't even want that to happen. So I think that it needs to be looked into, because I don't really think this is just a sellout. It says, okay, you can bomb all the Kurds you want just as long as you help us fight ISIS. I don't really think that that's the case.
Yeah. Well, I have no knowledge of how the U.S. policy is being formulated or what exactly is the U.S. policy. All I know is what I hate to say this, what I read in the papers. I sound like Will Rogers or something, but that really is an area in which there's a virtual blackout. And one of the reasons why I've asked Bob to be with us is he has been there and he has followed the news in that region much more closely than either Abe or I. Anyway, we have other callers.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for the call. And you're helpful. 231-8187. Vernon, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about the impact of climate on this entire conflict.
Whoa.
I understand that Iraq is experiencing record high temperatures, that Syria has had drought since before the conflict started that was displacing people. What is the overall impact of this climate change on the entire regional conflict?
That's a really good question. Bob, do you have any thinking on that?
Well, I think I agree. It's a really good question, and it's one that no one's ever posed in all the time. So, obviously, in northern Syria, there are tremendous problems with water and irrigation and crops, of course. So there is a kind of a food crisis going on. I'm really don't feel qualified to speak about Iraq and Syria's environmental questions, but across the border in North Kurdistan, in Turkey, the environmental movement is really strong and really active, and this is spread through a lot of Turkey. The Turkish government is very intent on building hydroelectric dams, and increasing their electricity output as part of the government's love of or embrace of the energy sector in Turkey. The Kurdish movement and the environmental movement work very closely to stop the dams, to stop the hydroelectric stations because of the environmental crisis that they pose.
Yeah, just so people understand, when these dams are built, I think on the Tigris, or is it the Euphrates? I think it's the Euphrates. When these dams are built, the gross result of that for places like Iraq is that there's a reduction in available water for agriculture.
Yes, exactly. So how does Kurdistan then begin to feed itself, and what happens, right? Mm-hmm. When it can't? This is sort of creating facts on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. It really, if these dams and the ecological crisis that they create are successful, it will negatively impact North Kurdistan's ability to self-govern, right? Mm. Right. So the caller is raising an excellent point. A lot of this is driven by either a fear of environmental crisis or by actual occurring environmental crises.
You know, it's important for people, everybody may know this, but it's important to understand that a drying up of Lake Baikal way back, and I don't even remember how far back, produced the great movements of ethnic Turkic peoples,
right.
All the way from what really would be like Mongolia and places like that, all the way to Turkey itself. And this is a long time ago. And the fact of the matter is that climate change, whether the kind we're talking about in current terms or in the past over other issues, other causes, really have an impact that kind of cancels out local or regional politics. It's a case of a man proposes but God disposes, you know.
Well, we have over a million refugees now in Turkey, right?
Right.
And it's a great question that the caller raised, yeah.
No, I think it's really an important issue, and I think the United States, in terms of its public utterances and behaviors, doesn't seem to be making any effort to be aware of all this. And meanwhile, we have a Congress in the United States that is dominated by people who are denying climate change.
Right.
Yeah, so that's really important. We have some other callers.
Yeah, let's try to get one more in before the end. I'm sorry, who is it, Steve? Camilo, good morning.
Yes, I want to know if you're familiar with an article that appeared in the New Yorker by a writer named Khachaturian about the relationship between the Armenians and some of the Kurds in Turkey.
Yes, I'm familiar with the article.
I don't know the article. What is its overall premise?
Well, essentially what the article said is that in the genocide, Kurds were exploited by the Turks and were a spearhead in the genocide against the Armenians.
Mm.
And what has happened recently is that there's been a reconciliation.
Yeah, so that's true. The Kurds apologized through the liberation movement to the Armenians. The HDP, the People's Democratic Party, was able to elect 4 Armenians to parliament in the last June 7 elections. They have just... The Armenians who were elected have done incredible work through the HDP. When I said before that I think the Armenian genocide is continuing, I think I said also that it's cultural and political, and we can see that in the government's attempt to destroy a well-known Armenian orphanage in Istanbul and the resistance that Kurds and Armenians and the People's Democratic Party and other progressive forces have put up to block that demolition.
Is this also related to the plans of the current Turkish government to essentially destroy parks and other services to build businesses that will apartment buildings and other structures that will increase the cash flow for the Turkish government?
Yeah, I think so, but I think it also stands on its own as an example of continuing Armenian cultural genocide. But your point's well taken. Now, when you fly into Ahmed or Diyarbakir, the signs that greet you there are in Kurdish, Turkish, and Armenian, which always brings tears to my eyes, right?
Hmm.
The main Armenian church in Diyarbakir, Ahmed, has been rebuilt. And is used now. There's a tiny Armenian community. Many people whose families were forced to convert during the genocide have rediscovered their Armenian roots. This is not just a question of saying, oh, I'm religious. It's also a kind of soul or spiritual journey with a progressive side to it, I think, in most cases. The act of coming out as an Armenian is in Turkey is pretty radical, and they will get support from the People's Democratic Party and the left before they get support from any other force.
We're going to have to leave it there.
We
I'm
have
afraid.
To leave it there. Bob Rossi, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much.
We may, if we may, sometime in the near future, bring you back. I really appreciate your expertise, and I want to thank our audience, and I want to urge people to stay tuned to KBOO. You're not going to hear this kind of news or this kind of discussion anywhere else, so stick around. It's always interesting, and it's got, I might add, the best music programming in the region.
Democracy is coming.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.